We do three things: vision, traction, healthy. Where are you headed? How do you get there? How do you bring it all on the ground, traction? And then how do you stay healthy? You get into a business because you want to do something great, be with people that you really like, and have a lot of fun. But sometimes those things over time tend to degenerate. Sometimes the financial results are not what's going on with the team results. You might have great results, but then in between there, nobody likes each other. The bigger thing, is there really a shared vision? When there's a shared vision, then you actually have a company. We actually really want to see more jobs for people in Hawaii and actually for our economy to flourish. One of my friends gifted me with what we call a life plan. We looked at all the good, all the bad stuff, and then we looked for all the strategic implications. And there's a favorite biblical story of this guy Nehemiah who actually rebuilds the wall of Jerusalem. And I really felt like I saw this wall like Nehemiah did. And actually, the first picture I saw was actually for Hawaii. So I actually felt like that was my calling, to come back, rebuild the wall of leadership in Hawaii.
Greater Good Radio, Connect, Learn, Heal, and Grow, is brought to you by Brain Gain Hawaii, a boutique executive recruiting, career development, and coaching firm. Learn more at braingainhi.com.
Welcome to Greater Good Radio. I'm your host, Evan Leong, and today's guest is Craig Chong, who is the president of Fresh Leadership and the co-founder with his wife, Sandy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here, Evan.
So when people first meet you,
yeah,
how do you introduce yourself?
I'm primarily an organizational consultant that helps people and leaders get better at what they do.
And what does that mean?
So we look at both kind of the life of the individual leader as well as the team that they lead. And so we say we do three things: vision, traction, healthy. So big picture, vision, where are you headed? How do you get there? How do you bring it all on the ground, traction? And then how do you stay healthy? What does that team look like? And because it's not just an individual leader, it's really a team that brings about the results. So how do you keep them healthy and going well?
So vision is like, where are we going, the objective and so on. And then traction is like rubber hitting the road and executing.
Yep.
And then healthy is like maintenance or what is that?
Relationships, communication, how are we doing, connecting, having just a lot of fun, because most teams don't have... You know, you get into a business because you want to do something great and you want to be with people that you really like and have a lot of fun. But sometimes those things over time tend to degenerate. It's like, it's just entropy and you have to constantly maintain.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when I look at, you know, people's careers and so on, so people come to me and say, okay, I want to move job or I want to improve my career or so on. When I look at it, there's always like three stages that I'm looking at. One is execution, you know, getting things done and so on. The layer beneath that is going to be direction, like where exactly are we going and why?
Yeah.
Right? Values and things like that. And then there's one before that, which is like repair and healing.
Mm-hmm.
Because the why will determine the direction, right? And then you can execute on that to go there, hopefully in that order. A lot of times it's opposite, right?
Yeah.
Which gets people in trouble. But the healing determines the why. You know, the healing and repair, like the wounds that somebody has determine, or the organization as a whole, it determines the why. It determines like, where are we going? Because if we're going there because we're trying to avoid this pain, right? That's very different than we're going to go here because we are led to it and pulled to it and drawn there from some type of purpose.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So is that kind of similar then, or...
Yeah, it is in a sense, but I think we would probably, I think we approach it in probably the same way. Sometimes the logic shifts. Sometimes it's very logical. It's like, all right, where are we going? Now, how do we organize a team to get to that mission? And then how do we keep them healthy? But oftentimes when we start, it's going, wow, this is pretty messed up, right? It's pretty dysfunctional. So we kind of have to start.
Even on a company that's doing really well?
Yeah. Sometimes the financial results, you know, are not what's going on with the team results. The ends justify the means, right? So you might have great results, but then in between there, nobody likes each other and people want to leave. So they're cranking out all these results, but everybody wants to leave the organization. You know, if they had a better offer, they would leave, you know?
So in all of your coaching and consulting, how many years has that been?
We're probably over 20 years. Yeah.
So in 20 years,
what's
the most prevalent kind of shared common issue that shows up that's preventable?
Gosh, I would say the key thing is really a lot of times there's huge miscommunications, right? And it has to do on two levels. One, it's an interpersonal level. How are we communicating and what are our styles and what does that look? The other is really being clear about where we're going, what that vision looks like. And I don't know if that's hitting it, but those are probably the two. So I would say that it's
really... Is it a shared vision as a group or is it a vision of whoever the leader at the top is?
Well, I think the leader at the top thinks they've got it all figured out. But having the bigger thing, is there really a shared vision? When there's a shared vision, then you actually have a company. If not, you really have a solo entrepreneur, right? And sharing that vision takes time, takes effort. And I think that's part of why we're in business. That shared vision is huge, you know?
Okay. So what would be your shared vision?
Shared vision for us is we actually want to help businesses get better at doing their business. And the why, I think that would be kind of the what, but really the why is we actually really want to see more jobs for people in Hawaii and actually for our economy to flourish and people actually to have ownership and wealth built up rather than basically all the mainland companies owning it. And I think for us, it's really a picture of many years ago when I started this business, one of my friends gifted me with what we call a life plan. He sat down with me and he went through my entire narrative of my life. We looked at all the good, all the bad stuff. And then we looked for all the strategic implications. And then really the decision was, this is postgraduate school. Was I going to stay in California or was I going to, you know, kind of risk it and go over to Asia, maybe do some work in Asia? Or would I come back home? At the time I was dating Sandy, my wife. And as we're sitting there and we're kind of talking through, this is at the end of about 2 days, what should I do and kind of discerning where to go and what I should do. I actually had this picture of a wall. And there's a favorite biblical story of this guy, Nehemiah, who actually rebuilds the wall of Jerusalem. And I really felt like I saw this wall of like Nehemiah did. And what it was just this picture of rocks being placed and building sort of like a wall, which is in the biblical narrative is really a picture of protection and health. And actually the first picture I saw was actually for Hawaii, the leadership walls were kind of all broken down. And it's sort of like Jerusalem had been overrun by different nations and so forth. But really the call for Nehemiah was really, how do you rebuild the wall? So I actually felt like that was my calling, to come back, rebuild the wall of leadership in Hawaii. And it's just one leader at a time and helping them understand their purpose, their calling, and align the teams around them. And to date, I think we've been able to work with like 125 different companies and a couple thousand leaders. So yeah, it's pretty amazing. And yeah, that's kind of the vision or what we're trying to do is like, how do we work with leaders that really want to do the right thing for Hawaii and become part of that wall. So when we look back at all of our past clients, it's sort of like it's a wall and they're actually helping hold up protecting Hawaii for the future.
With that being said, what context do I need to understand why that's important for you?
Well, I think the context is that I believe everything rises and falls on leadership. Is a cliche kind of saying. But I think for me, it's realizing that when I work with individual leaders, it's affecting a community of people. And like, for example, like say one employer has say 200 people, those 200 people have dependents. And if I can work with one leader or one leadership team of, you know, half a dozen to a dozen, I get to affect those 200 people plus their families. So I think for me, it's looking for impact, and it's kind of why I love leadership. When I went to study in grad school, I studied in this guy, Dr. J. Robert Clinton, and his whole focus was not a really wide public kind of audience, but really how does he work with leaders who actually help other leaders? And that was his focus. And his studies took me to grad school. His book was called Making of a Leader. And that's kind of, when I look at what he does, it's the same kind of feel that I do what I do. So I think the context of leadership is that I realized that, yeah, going back to an even bigger story, you know, we're Chinese, right? So we're fourth generation Chinese American. My great grandfather on my dad's side immigrated to Hawaii. And on his way, his name was CQ Yihop. He was on his way from China to the West Coast. And he stopped in Hawaii and he ended up staying and started a meat market, which became kind of the first superstore of Chinatown. We still have property in Chinatown. And he ended up staying in Hawaii, starting this business, taking on other partners. And he basically built this empire. They had all kinds of real estate holdings, all kinds of businesses, everything from a brewery to a supermarket to a ranch where they farm koa. So they had the whole supply chain. So in his day, he was kind of a billionaire in Hawaii. But he ended up having three different wives, four boys, and I think there were like 12 girls. So because of that large family, my grandmother was from the second wife, and she was the second daughter. And the girls got nothing, but the four boys got everything. And what I realized is that even though we have this great history, what ended up happening was the boys got like 90% of all of the shares of the business, and the boys would fight. And the girls got little or nothing. And for me, I thought, well, I'd love to be a part of the family legacy and business, but it was super dysfunctional. And all of those resources that we had out there basically didn't get used because people were fighting all the time. And that dysfunctionality was not healthy. So when I think about my background was ag business, because I thought I'd go into the family business, maybe go into some kind of agriculture production. But what I realized is that the family was not able to come together on a lot of these different things. So now it's basically a land holding company rather than actually growing. They're one of the big businesses of Hawaii. And as a result, I think something was lost there. So there's even assets now, but they're just very passive assets. There's no active operating company. And it's just sad. It's like three generations later and there's nothing, you know, or there is, there's something there, but it's not growing and it's not alive. So I think for me, that's kind of the context or the background of answering the question of, well, why do I help leadership teams do the things that they do? Because I don't want to see, especially family businesses, I don't want to see them where our family was, you know, a couple generations and it's all gone, right? So how can we set them up? What are the structures? What are the right protocols? As you're talking about, even just on a relational level, those are the same kinds of things that we do with in the business as in a healthy relationship.
That's good, because that was taking me exactly where I was going to ask on, which is like, what's the origin story? Yeah. What reasoning under that kind of why, right?
I think the other origin story, so that's on my dad's side. On my mom's side, my grandfather, the Hu side, my great-grandfather, his name was Akanahu. And one of the interesting pieces of history that I've been realizing was that he actually immigrated from China. And we were actually going through all of these old immigration records. And just recently, one of my cousins immigration interviews. And it talks about what he did. His name was Akanahu. And one of the neat things is that for the Chinese community, he was actually very good friends with Mr. Colburn, who was actually King Kalakaua's, one of his aides. Because he had this relationship and he would cook food for them and do all these different things, they would have parties and they would hire him to do all stuff. He could speak Chinese and Hawaiian. And I keep wishing that, you know, he married somebody Hawaiian, then we can go to KS, but, you know, can't do that. Basically, when anybody had something to do with property or have anything to do with the government, they would actually go through my great-grandfather. So he was like this counselor. And I think for me, I realized that that's kind of my role and my calling is really, I call it a consultant, but oftentimes I do a lot of counseling with, you know, heads of companies. Sometimes we're doing government work too, but it's like, how do you go through somebody? So I think that's a big part of kind of what and how I do what I do is really being a good counselor and giving wise counsel both to whatever party on each side, you know. whether it's an employee, employer, or just helping people figure out what's important.
So would you say that the underlying energy and drive comes from pain, or does it come from purpose, or what would be the kind of the ratio?
I would say that right now the drive is more, not necessarily pain, but it's more from, it's really from purpose. Because a couple years ago, when HECO was actually going through a merger at Nextera, we started using some material from a friend of mine, this guy, Pat Lencioni. It's called Five Dysfunctions of a Team. And I'm actually doing this training and we're helping transform the leadership of the organization. And in the midst of that training, and I'm explaining this concept of five dysfunctions of a team, which are number one, vulnerability, based trust, and then you're having healthy conflict, then you have really good buy-in, then you have accountability, and finally results. And yeah, you, like we were saying earlier, you can have results, but if you don't have all of the other base pieces, you kind of have a dysfunctional organization, and they layer, it's a pyramid.
So that's what you need to have, and if you don't have it, yeah, then there's dysfunction.
Yeah, and it shows up in a number of different ways. What I realized was I was actually live doing training with about 20 people, and I was explaining this concept, and I was actually helping them discover their own narratives in how that relates to things. And as I was explaining mine, it just dawned on me that, wow, we come from, on one side of the family, we come from this long line of a dysfunctional business practices or family relationships. And what I'm actually doing is I'm actually helping to heal that with businesses today. And it was kind of a big aha moment for me where I was sitting there in the midst of it and I was just kind of losing it because I was like, well, this is part of your calling. And that's really the purpose. It's like, okay, yeah, there was pain there. It's not necessarily a great story of what happened with a great bit, but it's like, what can we learn from it? And how can I help others? And that's kind of what drives me today. I just want to help more businesses be healthy. And at the same time, all the other pieces come together.
When you can help the organization or the leader maybe become aligned or become more functional, does that feel like whatever dysfunction you felt in your own family gets healed as well?
Yeah, I would think a little bit. I think for me, it's like I'm adding to the equation. We don't have a family business other than our business to actually help and guide. But
not so much the business side, but
yeah,
the dysfunctional piece. What I'm saying is that a lot of times, and this is what I've noticed in myself as well, the things that I'm endeavoring toward professionally and out and expressing into the world are really just projections of what's going on in me internally, especially at the root piece is if it has a lot of charge. If I have to do this for some reason, it has to be done no matter what. There's some history in there. So what I'm wondering is with that history of, you know, having a really large business,
yeah,
and then having it come apart, and along with it coming apart are the relationships within the family.
Yeah.
By putting it together for others right now, would that be a projection of what was going on internally from the ruptures, from the family piece? And if so, then is there a feeling of repair? When I repair this externally, my internal gets kind of repaired as well.
I think it does. There's a fulfillment piece of like, all right, this is actually doing something that's right. I think when you're talking, I was thinking, connecting it, it's like, yeah, my dad's side of the family, but even my dad, our relationship was kind of dysfunctional. And, you know, he would say, you know, children are to be seen and not heard. Very old school. And we wouldn't, you can relate to that,
yeah,
right?
My mom has that. My mom is very, yeah. Children should be seen and not heard as the only child.
And it's just really, how do you have those conversations? So it took many years for us to have meaningful conversations. So I think that that's part of just on a personal, even going, how is our personal family not dysfunctional, which brings a lot of fulfillment. And I think I get a lot of fulfillment from helping. And I think it probably does help me heal and repair myself when I feel like, wow, they actually talked about the things that really matter. And they really trusted us as a trusted advisor at that level for things that most people would never share. That's a privilege, you know?
Well, that makes sense too, because on one side, you have somebody who's a trusted advisor, people sharing vulnerable information.
Yeah.
Vulnerable meaning like I open myself up to being wounded.
Yeah.
And then one of those five dysfunctions piece, right? And on the other side, you have children should be seen and not heard, which essentially means you're not seen, you're not heard, and therefore you're not valued. That's the message, right? So on one side, there's no value. On the other side, there's high value. And then it becomes, how do we bridge these two so that I'm high value?
And I think that's pretty much is going, you know, it's the question of, I think it was thrown out to, I was in a group and the question was, you know, the things that kind of plague you and are heavy-hearted on you, would you wish that you didn't have those things? Or are those the things that actually shaped you to who you are? And it's really this thing of going, yeah, there's different shaping events in our life, both positive and negative. And sometimes the negative ones are the ones that actually build your character. And you're like, I actually have to work hard at that. One of my clients said, he said, what you do is you come in and you actually heal organizations. And I've used that for quite a while. I'm like, okay, that's kind of how I approach things. And I think about that rather than just going. So I think that helping heal other people or other organizations brings, I think, what was maybe taken from me, or I felt maybe I missed. So I think there's that reconciliation that's really powerful. You know,
there's something else you just mentioned where you said that some of the things that happen to us that are negative, they shape us or they could or so on, right?
Yeah.
When I hold that statement, I used to think the same way.
Yeah.
And then now when I look at things, I realize that, hey, as a young child, everything is about good, bad, right, wrong, positive, negative, right? And that's how the gauge works of, am I a good person or am I not? Because if I'm good and I'm right and I'm valued, then my caregivers, my parents, or whoever around me that is taking care of me will find value in me. I have a much higher chance of staying alive, right? That's why I got to be, you know, I got to be right. I got to be good. And then you have this judgment system going on. So I break it down nowadays into painful or not painful, but good, bad, right, wrong, positive, negative is only a snapshot in time depending on which part of it is judging it right now, right? Because you go 10 years in the future and you go, no, that was good, that was positive, whereas in the moment, it's like, this is bad, this is negative, or so on. But even when you go forward 10 years and you consider back, there's no doubt whether it was painful or not.
Post-grad school, I mentioned in this guy, Terry Walling, and he had us do these timelines. And he would do a post-it note timeline. So we figure out what is the narrative, how does it fall out? And then you kind of look for themes. So that's kind of how do leaders develop over a lifetime? What can you see? And he was a same disciple of this guy, Clinton. We both studied under him, but Clinton would say, hey, you have negative process. You have different kinds of process items, both positive and negative. And what Terry did was he simplified everything. So he would say everything with a yellow post-it note is just kind of event, person, place, or event that shaped you. And then he would say, I want you to go back and replace all of those with things that are bring about pain, you know, and what are those are shaping items as well. And they might have kind of a negative processing, or it might be an isolation moment. It might be different kinds of things that happen to you. But yeah, we have pain, and it's really, how do you not just know that you have pain? And sometimes it's unprocessed pain. Unprocessed pain is kind of like, gosh, it's trauma. It's sort of like a cut that you cover back over, but it's still pussing up.
Yeah, it's trauma. Yeah. Unhealed wound.
And being able to process that in the last season has been really powerful. You know, just being able to have some trusted friends to walk through that, talk through that, and just realize that, yeah, when you move into that wound or that area of pain, that there's something there that's very powerful that makes you uniquely you. And oftentimes it's hidden and it's moving in and through the pain to find that purpose. And
it's hidden in general, or it's just hidden to the person in the pain?
Yeah, it's hidden to the person in the pain because they can't process it. So it's still at a, in a sense, a basal level part of your brain. So there's no cognitive thinking about it. Or you just remember it a certain way, and that shapes how you operate on your day-to-day level.
And then did you go into it at all, the things that you don't actually know or remember?
Yeah, I think there is both and. So I think there is the things that you can recognize. And then part of it is even when you do like a family tree genome. I remember when I was in seminary grad school, I took family systems theory. You start mapping all this stuff up and you go, wow, And you try and go back about 6 or 7 generations, and you're like, wow, this is pretty messed up, you know? Or our running joke was, my family is more effed up than your family. Let me show you how, you know? And yeah, just being able to do a family tree is powerful. And realizing that some of the things that we're dealing with come from a generational setup. Things that you had nothing to do with. It's really a part of what we call your sovereign foundation. And yeah, I'm sure there's more that I don't understand, but you know, being able to kind of look at some of it from a thematic standpoint, looking beyond my own timeline to my ancestors.
Yeah. I mean, that stuff is so important to me because, you know, the ancestral healing, generational trauma that becomes developmental and then becomes generational as it gets passed down the line affects us in such ways that we don't even know it. It's invisible until it's not invisible.
Yeah.
Right. So Carl Jung said, until you make the unconscious conscious, it will lead your life and you'll call it fate.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm super focused on that line of thinking these days.
Mm, yeah.
And I really like, I think I mentioned this to you before, is there's a book called My Grandmother's Hands. It's written by a guy named Resma Menakem, who is an African-American therapist that talks about how trauma moves through the body through history and so on. So he says, you know, through time, trauma gets decontextualized. You forget about it, right? So the trauma definition I want to use is it's not what happens to us. It's what happens in us as a result of what happens to us. Or a result of what should have happened but didn't. So, you know, I get in a car accident, right? That's traumatic.
Yeah.
However, most of the wounds and injuries from that should be healed within 6 months or a year, right? It's what didn't heal, like invisibly or could be visibly, that becomes the trauma.
Yeah.
Right? Now I can't drive or I'm scared about looking off my left side of the shoulder or I'm having these muscle twitches or things like that. You know what I mean? It's those things that are the trauma, right? So over time, you forget kind of the context of it and the occurrence, right? Especially as you go through generations. So the quote is something along the lines of, trauma decontextualized in a people over time looks like culture, right? Trauma decontextualized in a family over time looks like family traits. Trauma decontextualized in a person over time looks like a personality. And then I made up my own, which was, trauma decontextualized in a company over time looks like company culture. When you understand the context and why it was in there, everything makes sense. Right? The problem with that is through attrition, you know, people passing away and so on, that doesn't get identified or told. And the other thing is that nobody wants to talk about it, right? You really want to go and share your most painful stuff with other... No, people don't typically do that. And that's where the children should be seen and not heard. Do you really think that that person is going to actually say, this is what was painful in our family or what happened to me or so on? That ain't happening. So now you have all these characteristics of things and behaviors and so on passed down and you don't even know why.
Yeah. No, I was just thinking about kind of our connection, you know, for us. And it was Auntie Jenny. She was kind of my mom's aunt, but she never had any kids. So she kind of took care of us as her own. And then she used to come and hang out with you and your family a lot and talk about your mother. So that's my mom's sister, but she never had any kids.
I think she used to come here all the time.
Yeah, she used to come here all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and then we didn't realize that till a couple years ago, right?
Yeah.
But I think one of the things, like even, I think I was in grad school, but we were really close. So I remember I did some interviews with her and then she would tell me about her upbringing, you know, and how she was the youngest child and then their parents had both passed away and they had immigrated and then they got passed around. Her and my grandmother got passed around with all the brothers and the different things that happened. And, you know, I'm sure she didn't tell me everything, but there were some deep wounds there, you know, of pain and being abandoned and being feeling like an orphan, you know, and it's just going, wow, that's... Yeah, I got to go look up some of those notes that I have and kind of reread through those. But yeah, it's just kind of when you start asking the questions, but it's just really when you start hearing these things, then you start really understanding the context or get and actually get the right perspective, right?
Yeah.
We think, well, we're just dealing with what we're dealing with here, but there's actually far more than we're dealing with, or what's really the history behind this.
Yep.
In our Western world, we tend to want to just move on, just show the bottom line and everything's better and, you know, bigger and we keep progressing. But yeah, that's not always what's healthy, right? It's like, how do you stop, take time, reflect? What does that look like? You know,
it's the interesting thing too. This morning I was doing a short meditation before you came, trying to settle myself and so on. And what kind of came to me was when I first traveled to Taiwan, what I noticed was everybody's family name was first, and then their actual given name, their birth name was second.
Yeah.
So for me, I'm Evan Leong here in the United States. Yeah. Over there, I'm Leong Evan.
Mm.
Right? Over there, you're Chong Craig.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's such a different perspective because, especially in Hawaii, when we ask somebody for what school did you go to, we don't care a lot of times if you're local over here what college they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We're asking them what high school did they go to? What middle school did they go to? Because it tells us so much about them. What school did you go to? Oh, what year did you graduate? Oh, you played sports at that. Oh, you did this here. I know a lot about you at that point.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The same thing with the family name, right? It's the family name is first and from the ancestors from before that. And the idea here is that you come with all of your family and ancestors first. That is such a different way of viewing things in the West.
Yeah.
Which to me creates a lot of disconnection and confusion. Because if I'm an individual, only me, then everything I feel, everything that goes through me, everything that I do and so on is all me. And that's not really true. That's never true.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like you can say, oh, you did these businesses and I cannot take credit for a lot of things.
Yeah.
Because guess what? I didn't pay for my schooling. You know, I didn't pay for my household.
Yeah.
I didn't do these things. It's the collective whole of everybody that has, you know, held the space for that. And, you know, it takes a village to raise a child, that whole piece, right?
Yeah.
So different when we're in this kind of Western culture, which is all about the individual.
Yeah.
Right? To me, that just creates disconnection, and disconnection creates dysregulation and unease and pain and so on.
Yeah. I was just thinking about, it's really this quote that my mentor used to say. He says, basically, you stand on the shoulders of other giants that have come before you, right? On the family side, you know, as you're talking, I was thinking about, I was reflecting my great-grandmother's on her immigration interviews. And basically, it took 53 days to sail from, you know, southern China to Hawaii. It's like 53 days. That's just over 2 months, you know. It blows your mind, right? We fly to Asia and back in, you know, less than a day, right? But it's just like, wow, what if they didn't take that risk? What was their situation and what did that look like, right? And it's just really, sometimes we forget to think about that. What kind of sacrifices did they make? Or even closer, what are the sacrifices your grandparents or parents made, right? Or the kind of sacrifice we make for our kids? Right. It's this dichotomy of, moving forward, but at the same time, what's that reflection of the past look like? And how do you give thanks for that? It's important.
What's the answer?
I think it's a careful balance. You know, I was just kind of reflecting yesterday on kind of what is a Sabbath, you know, in the biblical context. It was like, well, take rest once every 7 days or every 7 years, they'll actually let the fields go fallow. Right. And do we take Sabbaths? We do it in academic institutions, but what does that look like for an individual, right? How do we take time to think and not just be working and doing and reflecting back? And even in the context that we're talking, it's going, how far back do you reflect? How do you get to that level of perspective, right? Because if you're just thinking, oh, what's the next sales goal that you're going to hit, or what's the next, you know, thing that you want to achieve, it's just so out of context rather than thinking about the bigger picture, right?
If we move a little bit into kind of the coaching consulting piece, when you're dealing with leadership in as your clientele, how much of the work is actually on the company?
Yeah.
And how much of the work is on themselves?
I would say I get hired to work on the company, but as we get in there, it's half-half. It ebbs and flows. A lot of times, what we talk about is really a whole whole person coaching perspective. So oftentimes we'll start off talking about the company, but that kind of has a mirror image on their personal family, marriage life, or even with their kids, or whatever it looks like on their family, even in-laws and so forth, or friendships, you know, and that same thing going on there is the same root cause issue that's going on in the business. So sometimes we'll shift over and we'll talk about what's going on with the family, and that's actually the same things that are showing up in the business and vice versa. So sometimes it gives...
What do you mean vice versa? So it could be the business showing up in the family, or is the actual root cause onus like the person's family or themselves first, and then that gets externalized into the company?
Yeah, of course it's going to be the person kind of flowing, if you think about the logic, but sometimes we'll spend a lot of time on the business perspective of what's going on with their business, and then we'll shift over and we'll spend some time on the family side. You know, when I'm coaching a senior executive, it's all open. And actually, the family part is the part that's not managed as much as kind of the business, because in a sense, we're paying bills here, but I'll spend time over here because it's actually much more meaningful for the client when we get there.
When I'm dealing with people who are looking for other work or so on, like when I'm recruiting or I'm coaching and so on, I almost am never seeing like what presents as the actual root issue, the root cause. Never. It's always something underneath. You know, somebody wants to leave and they're saying, I can't stand this anymore, this and that. Listen for a little bit longer, maybe kind of ask some questions here and there and so on. And eventually then it becomes, you know what? My boss is, it reminds me of my dad. My dad makes me feel like crap. I can't be around this. Right? Which means then if you move to the next role, because you're trying to heal that wound.
Yeah.
Hey, wound's still there. So your shadow, you cannot like escape your shadow. It moves with you.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's going to look the same thing at the next place.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that happening with your clients, or are you saying that, sometimes it could be a business thing and the business is really what's affecting the person?
Yeah, sometimes it's just the business, because sometimes it's just the simple context of what they're set up for, right? So it's a different kind of context, right? So sometimes when you move the context, things get a lot healthier and a lot better. But yeah, their shadow does travel with them. So I think it's both and. So it's the context, but it's also the environment that you're moving into. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we can move you into a brand new house, but you're like, all right. So it feels really great, but still the old you is still in there. So how do you deal with that? But also it's a blend of, if you feel good in a really nice house, then maybe you have some comfort and you have some margin to be able to work on the other stuff. So I think we go back and forth on it. But overall, it's really what I like to say is, how do you stabilize a patient first? Right. Because the patient is just in trauma, and they're in trauma. Sometimes you got to just move them so that you stabilize them so they're not getting impacted by that trauma over and over first. And then there's space for them to work on other things. Because I think you have so many pillars in your life. And if you think about a chair, you can kind of balance on three legs. But, you know, of course, it's great to have four. But if you take out two legs, you can't balance a chair at all. Like, I could balance a chair with three legs, but not with two out. You know, it'd be harder. You know, it becomes much harder. Or one leg. So
you just become the balance.
Yeah. So it's just going how much, and then I end up help them balance, right? So
chair with no legs would be hard.
Yeah. So I think you can do, but it's just how many and what are they used to, right? Can they handle that? And sometimes all of the legs
can they handle that is an absolutely, absolutely crucial piece.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you handle it?
Yeah. How much maturity and emotion and energy do they have to do? But if you take out too many pillars, clients, from a psychological standpoint, they can crash, and you don't really want them to do that.
Kind of fine. It's like, how much pain can you actually handle?
Yeah.
Is really what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a careful balance, because sometimes it's like, all right, if they're the owner of the business and they can't really move anywhere, you know, but at the same time, they've got to feed all these people. There's tremendous pressure on that side, right? So they've got all of these people that they're trying to feed, plus their dependents, and that compounds.
What have you seen in regards to belonging and how to foster a sense of belonging within the organization?
In what sense? From a company set?
Because, you know, the sense that somebody feels like they belong will determine a lot of times how much they engage.
Yeah.
Right? When they feel connected to this company, then they're engaging. When they feel disconnected, they disengage. And that sense of belonging is a feeling. So
yeah,
I think about this one a lot. And I saw it really clearly this weekend when I went to Waikiki with my daughters. We went walking around and cruising around into the different like stores, you know, all the expensive kind that I cannot buy anything from. But, you know, we cruised in them because they wanted to see it. And I remember going through one kind of department store-ish. And I don't know if it's the lighting or the displays or something, but actually initially I was like, well, I don't belong here. And I had to kind of sit there and feel it because I'm uncomfortable with this place a little bit. And then I was like, oh, I feel like I don't belong. And then I was like, oh, this reminded me of the first time that I went to a mall in Oregon when I went to, you know, college. And people were staring at me and stuff. And I was like, I don't belong here, man. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm in the middle of Hawaii. Family's been here for generations. I belong here, but I definitely felt like, oh, I don't know if I belong here, right? When you have that in a company from your from the people that work there, their time is numbered. Their days are numbered.
Because usually there's value misalignment. So I would say that, I mean, it's very simple in my mind, but it's really, what's your values alignment and do your values align with what the companies are? So when you're talking about how do you feel like you belong? So when we're working with an organization, they build a shared vision. And that shared vision we do in, I mean, 8 questions. So what are your core values? What does the behaviors look like? And when there's alignment, the top leadership team, and then they actually cascade that down, it just becomes really clear of who are the people that should work here and who should not, right? And then you're building kind of a shared mission statement of, do I believe in that or not? And then you have a 10-year target of, hey, can we agree on here's where we want to be in 10 years or not? And then it's like, how do we go to market? Who's our target market? What does that look like? And then 3-year picture, you boil it down to one, and then every quarter. So when you have those questions kind of laid out in a way that you get buy-in at every level, especially for the leadership team, I find that our leadership teams bond and they go, all right, that's part of really where in the mind of a leader, they have probably 80% of it. But when they realize who are the people they've invited on the ship to do it with, they have a little bit of their say in it. And when you're able to do that as a leadership team, that's that. They actually feel like they belong. Or sometimes we actually have people that help author that and they exit from the organization and it usually has to do with values. Values, and they're not following the values. So even though they help initiate or create part of it, they exit out. And when you align more people that fit all those values and you hire according to that, then you have people that feel like they belong. And then you cascade that down. But it really starts with the top tier. And if that alignment is not there, then you're going to see dysfunction. And when that dysfunction happens, it just ripples throughout the organization, big or small. So I think when they feel like they belong, they've had input. And also there's regular places where they're actually refreshing that because kind of a strategy or plan or these things of mission, vision, values, they tend to evolve. They're timeless to a certain extent, but they tweak just a little bit and you kind of have to re-up it. So I feel like when a team really belongs, they're actually practicing some basic protocols of how they meet. One would be that they're meeting every quarter for a day, completely away to think about this stuff. And then annually, they're doing a deep dive. They're doing 2 years and they're working on deeper things as far as relational connectivity and going, you know, way below the surface. And then every week they have regular meetings. And when those aren't happening, there's systems to call other meetings that they stay on the same page. So I think when you have the right kind of what we call meeting pulse, things just flow. And not just the team belongs, but then they push that down and everybody feels more and more that they belong. And the people that don't fit the culture or the organization, they tend to exit pretty quickly. And it seems like, well, it's very disruptive. But when you start going, okay, here's what we're looking for, and you know what you're looking for, like you're looking for this red sports car, you're going to see it everywhere. And then you start recruiting that in. And then it becomes more aligned. And they may not be, it might be a red truck or something, but it's like, what do we really need? And are the people, the right people in the right seat on the bus, as Collins would say, right?
When you say, what is it they really need?
Yeah.
Because everything leads to a need to me, right?
Yeah.
It's, you know, you have a conflict, you have an argument, you have some type of issue or so on,
it's
due to an unfilled need,
mm-hmm.
right? Once that need's filled, you don't have those. That dissolves.
Yeah.
So what are you doing or seeing work in order to help either the person or the company properly identify what is the actual root and core need?
Yeah. So that really starts with what we call like an accountability chart. And it's really a supersized org chart that actually has their functional responsibilities. Because oftentimes you might have a business owner doing 10 different things, from everything from HR to sales to operations. And the question is, whose role should that be? Although you can do it all, and that's the hard part, is that although a lot of executives and business can do it all, the question is, should they be doing that? And then it's really going, what are the right functions and how do they connect and what are the nodes of what that looks like? When you get that right, when you get the structure right, health happens. It's sort of like, hey, bones. If you got your bones in the right order and your organs are working right, you know, you got a healthy body, right? So first thing is going, are all the bones in alignment and the hard stuff? And that's really, what are the functions of the organization? When you have the right function, rather than, a lot of times we're very relational people in Hawaii, so we like their person, but they may not be the right person for what the function needs. And that's really what the needs are. The needs are really, when we talk about it, is really what's the functional need to make the business move forward with that direction. But if not, some of the companies become nonprofits because they have all these people sitting around and they create all this chaos because they're not living out their calling. And as a result, they're doing mediocre work and we can't move the business forward because we don't have profitability to reinvest into new and grow new things. So you start feeding all these people, but they may not be doing what they're gifted for, their highest and best use. And even times, like I was having a conversation with a client last week and they got this great person, helped start the organization, but she can't keep up. The organization's grown, it's changed, and she can't keep up. And it's going, we like her, but we can offer her this other role that she really can do, but kind of Peter principle, we promoted her to a place where she's not competent. So you need to move her back. And if she doesn't want to, it's going, hey, not that we don't love you, but it's like, let's help you find the highest and best use for you. And it's really, how do you move into your calling, right? And that might be in another company, unfortunately, you know, but how do we help those people, you know, write letters and help you get to that place? And when we do that, sometimes we think about, I think our company, we think it's just this, just us. And how does that business owner do everything in there? But it's actually looking at the larger ecosystem, the larger perspective, and how do we help them get to where they can make a contribution.
So what's the biggest transformation you've seen?
I mean, it's pretty easy for me. I guess it's an opportunity that kind of a once in a lifetime opportunity, but we got invited to do the transformation of Hawaiian Electric. This was on the verge of NextEra taking over the company. And Alan Oshima invited me in, and we talk about this very openly, invited me in, and we started with their leadership team. And I had known him and I was working with him on a personal level. And then he got asked to be CEO. And we started with their leadership team. We took them on a retreat and it was just transformational for them. We dove into their stories. We dove into their personalities. And then we talked about how do they work together at a whole different level. And it was just on the merger just got announced. And what we saw was them just bond at a deep, deep level, them connect, be very open and honest with each other. We actually put into rhythm a cadence of how they would communicate, meetings, offsites, and so forth. And then originally I was just supposed to just work with the leadership executive team. And then they asked me to work with all 64 of their managers under them.
That individually?
We actually put them in cohorts.
Okay.
So I was part of coaching the Midyear fellows and they talked about cohorts. I said, how about we put these 64 people in cohorts cross-functionally across the islands? And we threw them into 4 cohorts and we organized them differently. And then we did retreats with them. And what was amazing was some of the people had been in the company for like 40 years. And they'd say, this is the first time I actually got to know this other person. And it just blew them away. And what happened when they were going through different kinds of issues or problems, rather than elevate everything to to 16 executives, they would actually pick up the phone afterwards. And we talk about how can they build relationships so that they pick up the phone and resolve things at that next level. And that was just pretty transformative through the whole company. And to watch them go through a failed merger and see how they progressed. And yeah, the goal of that was really how do we equip the next generation for Hawaii? You know, and the leaders of HECO today, of Scott Siu, Shelley, a whole bunch of them are leading the company today. And that was Alan's big thing, is going, hey, how do I help these younger leaders, give them the training that they need? And it ended up that we didn't go through with the acquisition, but we got very competent leaders. Even today, in the trying times that the company's going through, we got great leaders. And not only that, but they got great leadership teams with them that share the same values and that alignment. So it's been a really neat thing to kind of see all that succession planning start happening. But at the same time, they are not doing it on their own. Even though Scott's stepped up to HECO CEO, and then the leadership team rallied around him, and then he stepped up into the HEI role, and then Shelley moved up, and then the leadership team support her. It's pretty beautiful.
Were they getting along before, the executive team? They already got along pretty good?
Well, I think the executive team was a disparate group that got handed to Alan. So they knew each other. I would say that there were different factions of people, but they didn't see themselves as a cohesive team, because each department, I mean, some departments were $300 to $400 million in a department now. So they're bigger than most companies in Hawaii, most of these just individual departments. They didn't really see themselves as a primary leadership team. But when they were able to see themselves as, this is my first team, and how do we have conversations here versus the team that I spend time with every day below, that was transformational for them to operate as a leadership team. And then out of that, we developed a senior leadership team. So then Alan didn't have to work with all 16 people all the time.
So what is something that business leaders out there right now could implement internally in their company to build these connections?
I would say it's practicing vulnerability-based trust. My favorite book and friend, Pat Lencioni, has a book called 5 Dysfunctions of a Team. And I say, read that book, do an offsite retreat, practice the questions, and watch how vulnerability develops, and walk through the book.
So the book runs you through these questions.
Yeah.
I think I have that book.
Yeah. It's a leadership fable, but it's probably one of the most powerful business books out there.
So that concept is
vulnerability-based trust, right?
And then how would you define that?
That means that you actually lead with an area that people don't know about you. So like in the Jarhari window, it's really a whole thing of, hey, I want to expose something about myself. And we use 3 questions, really, really simple. You know, where'd you grow up? What birth order were you in? And then thirdly, what was kind of the biggest shaping event that shaped you in growing up in those years? Not necessarily your inner child, but, you know, what was the painful experience for you? And when leaders share those 3 things, man, it's amazing how they get to know each other. And they go, wow, okay, I was just doing this with a client last week. You know, they were like, they brought in some new people. I've been working with them for years. And we asked those questions. And then the owner, she's a only child. Single mom raised her, only child. And all of her leadership team all of a sudden understood her. It's like, okay, now we understand how to manage an only child, because you think the way we should do it is this and you just say it. But you don't have siblings to be able to have that conversation. And as a result, you think the world turns around you, you know? And even for her, she was able to realize, you know, for her, you know, in her mind, she's like, it's crystal clear as day. But if you don't have family members and you didn't grow up with multiple family members or a larger family, communicating that out is very different. Or even, you know, and it's just going, what does that look like? So it's a very quick way to dive in and discover who your leadership team is, how to build that base level. And it doesn't have to take a lot of time, you know? And it's as simple as those 3 questions.
How long did they know each other?
Half of the team, they've known each other for like years.
And then they didn't know that the leader was an only child.
Oh, they knew that. But sometimes they brought on 2 new ones and they didn't understand that. you know, but also it's going, when she's sharing that and understanding that perspective of, well, her work ethic of a mom that worked two jobs to send her to school, right? And understanding, well, she's the CEO of this company, but she basically built it completely on her own. It wasn't a hand-me-down, right? So their understanding of where she's coming from, or even she understanding her people. It's not just understanding the CEO, but the CEO understanding each other and that cross-functionality amongst all of these departments of how do we know each other? So it's a quick way to build trust to do that. The other thing that I would probably say for businesses to kind of get up and running is really, there's a book called Traction by Gina Wickman, a friend and mentor of mine. And when you read that book, answer the 8 questions of your vision, right? So what are your core values? What does that look and feel like? You know, what is your core focus? You know, why do you do what you do? 10 years, where do you want to be? And there's more questions, but it's like, how do you start answering those questions for yourself and then take your leadership team on a journey so that it's not just you holding everything up? A lot of leaders feel kind of the weight of, they're like, you know, kind of, they got big visions, but they never put it on paper and they expect everybody to understand it. And they never have time to talk about it because they're running around, they're too busy. So they're not working on the business, they're working in it.
What were those 3 questions before?
3 questions from Lencioni would be, you know, where did you grow up? A little bit about your family. Second thing is, what's your birth order in the family? Oldest, youngest, middle. What happens is we end up showing up in our family system in the company. Wherever your birth order was, has a huge impact. Third thing is, you know, what's a significant thing that shaped you or challenged growing up in that family of origin? Because usually those things get set before you're an adult, you know, and that's part of your sovereign beginnings of, like you're saying, what high school did you go to, right? And that's usually kind of where we start in Hawaii, you know, and that gives you a context, right? And, or kind of what's a little bit of, I always start off, you know, 4th generation Chinese American. What does that mean? Versus I'm just Chinese, right? And because I don't speak any Chinese, right? And it's just really what shaped you, you know?
So you're 4th generation?
Yeah.
To Chinese American here?
Yeah.
And then you are what in birth order?
I'm the oldest. So answering this your question, yeah. 4th generation Chinese American, went to public school, short stint at HBA, got kicked out, ended up finishing at Roosevelt. Parents, my dad used to work at Matson. My mom worked at the state. So working class family, grew up in Nuanu. Birth order, I'm the oldest. So of course, my parents made all the mistakes on me, but I'm also the bossy kid, just telling everybody what to do. And then what shaped me, I think, was my relationship with my dad, primarily. We would get into all kinds of things. He's passed away now, but he was very emotional. But we would never have emotional discussions, right? So growing up with a dad like that, as I said, children are seen and not heard. So he would work at Matson. He would put out all his energy. He had a lot of relationships. Everybody loved him. But when he came home, first thing that went up is a newspaper. He just had to be quiet and process. So I'm very much like him, but we never had any dialogue. So I think we used to get into all kinds of fights, because he would want downtime and I would want to connect. And he didn't know how to connect with me because he didn't have a dad growing up, or his dad died when he was very young. Mm. So his ability to actually father a kid or a son like me was really difficult, which led into a lot of conflict and bonding issues in my teens. But, you know, in my 20s, we reconciled a lot of stuff before he passed away, which is really good.
So mine would be, I grew up here in Manoa.
Mm-hmm.
My father was an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was a computer programmer at the University of Hawaii for mainframes.
Hmm.
I went to Punahou School.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at it, I'm not the typical, I mean, I barely got in. I barely stayed in, you know, although I identify with it, but I mean, I limped my way through there.
Mm.
My older sister was the Punahou Valedictorian and State Athlete of the Year.
Mm.
Stanford paid for her master's and her PhD.
Mm-hmm.
She's a Phi Beta Kappa, is a junior. She's a professor at USC Children's Hospital, does research and grants and so on with handicapped children.
Yeah.
So that's my older sister.
Yeah, yeah.
My younger brother is a lawyer. and also a Grammy-nominated musician.
Huh.
So he's got Grammy nominations, Hoku nominations, and
what,
so on.
What
so
kind of music does he play? Hawaiian music or
just guitar and so on? But with for the Grammys, because he was the audio engineer on Jeff Peterson's album, Jeff Peterson got a Grammy nomination, so the audio engineer gets it too. So yeah, so that's my younger brother.
What was the big shaping experience growing up, positive or negative? That big challenge for you growing up in your family of origin.
I think the piece for me then is my mother would always say that, you know, children, that's what she was taught to.
Mm.
My grandfather's side. Like, I mean, my mom's father was a pharmacist. And back in the day when you actually make your own medicines, right? So he would grow aloe vera. He would make his own lotions.
Mm.
He would make all this stuff. My mom's name is Diantha. He made a Diantha cream. And then he had a soda fountain, a soda plate, you know, business because... Back then, you would actually take the medicine. It tastes like total garbage.
Yeah,
so they have soda that you can kind of chase it with. And so
that's
kind of how that worked out. So he was entrepreneurial. He would make scarves and print on them, sell them during the war.
Yeah.
I mean, he grew up through the Depression. So all he did was work.
Mm.
Just constantly work.
Yeah.
I never really heard from him too much. And that other than, you know, he's always working and telling me and not, you know, helping. And I remember there was not a lot of like emotional... support. My dad would always say, you know, we're not going to tell you that we love you or anything like that, but we're always going to be there for you.
Mm.
I think what he was really communicating is I can't do it. I just physically can't do it due to what happened in my life or whatever.
Mm.
But I want you to know that we still love you. I just can't show it to you that way. So I will do things. That's how I interpret it. So I remember my, you know what bullock is, Jabong, right?
Yeah.
Right? So I have a tree. And we're picking it. And then I remember my brother, bullock fell on his head and he started to cry. And then my grandfather, my mom's father, came over and walked over to him. And I was thinking, oh, maybe he's going to, you know, comfort him. And he slapped him on the head. My brother was like, was kind of, so now he goes, stop me. Bah. He goes, you don't cry. You say, shit, the bullock fell on my head. Then he walked away. And my brother was like, stunned. And I think it's funny. I kind of, one part of me thinks, oh man, that's kind of bad and sad, but you know, I think it's kind of, that's funny because at least I wasn't the one getting slapped in the head on that one. But that kind of just shows like,
that's how
you show affection and comfort.
Yeah.
Get the slap in the head.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's how that shapes me so much, but that is kind of my piece, I think.
No, thank you for sharing that. I mean, it's kind of neat to see that. I never knew that your mom was a computer programmer. I mean, we never talked about your mom much, but it's just going, all right, so what's that? You know, obviously a lot of structure, right, from her. But I can see where the turning part with you, you love to talk, you're connected with people, you like helping people. But also the middle child, right? So it's like you got extremely successful sister, brother, you know, who gets to do, she's like medicine, but he's like music. He found his thing. And you're like in the middle. You're, you know, classic middle child, right?
Mm.
And connecting the dots, making peace, right? You're the one kind of living close to your parents, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and yeah, and it's just going emotionally, what did that look like, right? From, you know, seeing your brother. Oh, it's your brother.
That's my younger brother. He's probably like 5. Yeah, slap, pam. Like, oh. First is like, good thing that wasn't me.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's like, whoa.
Yeah.
I mean, my grandfather took care of us and stuff too. So it's not like it's all like, but it's emotional side was like that.
Yeah.
It's interesting too, I think on this, I had my own seat outside the class starting at kindergarten.
Mm.
Like the teacher could handle me to a certain point. But back then it's like, you know, you're going to isolate them, shame them and so on.
Yeah.
So I had my own seat outside the class.
Yeah.
So my parents said they remembered when they would come for parent-teacher conference.
Yeah.
And all of like the groundskeepers and everybody would be like, hi, Evan. And they're like, how do these people know your name? Like, I guess these people just know everyone's name.
Yeah.
And then they realize, oh God, you have a seat outside the class.
Yeah.
And you talk to them all day, right? Yeah, like, I talk to these people.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was so used to doing it that I got a job in the cafeteria. I talked to the, you know, I was always, I got what they call demerits. You have to work them off. So then I have to work it off. I'm friends with these guys. Ended up bringing them, like, plate lunch. They tell me, Evan, just go. You know, I don't have to work.
Mm.
And to this day, I'm talking 30 years later, some of them that still work there, I don't park anywhere I want. on campus. I still know them. We call each other by, you know what I mean?
It's
my ability to deal with like problems is really high. My ability to get into them is high. My ability to deal with them is high. So when my dad actually got really sick, when he got cancer and so on, I run point. I'm in charge. I'm the one that moves the needle. So I think for me that, yeah, maybe those ones shape into that. I'm the one that you want to talk to if you have a really big issue.
Yeah, yeah. How many years between you and your sister and you and your
brother? She's 3 years older. My younger brother is 5 years younger.
Okay. Yeah. Because I mean, I think for you, when I think about you, it's like I see a lot of classically like younger child, you know, styles of how you grew up, you know, which is pretty true, you know, in some ways, you know, because 5 years and then your younger brother comes, right?
No, my sister's 3 years older.
3 years older. Yeah. But you're the younger, you know.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Much. And then it's not quite exactly sandwich, but it's like, all right, you're just very playful, you know, classically getting to trouble, you know. But that's fun. No, it's neat to know that about you. But it's just a real simple, three questions, real simple way to connect with people and get to know them at a deeper level.
So you do that in a group?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so that's in the group and each person shares one by one?
Yeah.
So it takes quite a while if depending on the size of the group too.
You can actually get through in about an hour.
With how many people?
You know, half a dozen. The larger the group, the longer it takes, you know. But people start understanding, and that's just a starting place, right? And then you can go into a whole timeline and share a whole lot more, and that takes a lot longer, but you just need more time to do more processing. But when you start understanding the narrative of where people have come from, just in their lives, we're not even talking about generational stuff, right? That's huge. Right. Because then you have perspective of where they're coming from. You can kind of see why certain things throw them off or trigger other people. But you can also, if they're your teammate and you know them at that level, it's pretty valuable. You know, most people don't ask those questions. They see your position. They see the role that you do, either it's working or not. But when you ask the deeper questions, you can actually reframe things.
I'm always surprised about that. When I'm in especially a work-related situation, I'm brand new into that. You know, I meet somebody, I talk to them and so on. And then I'm like, I know things because I ask maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
So I remember this one, I was in Seattle and I was talking to one lady and she's like, oh yeah, it's my other good friend and so on, this and that. And then I met that other person that they said was their good friend, right? And I was talking to them, to that person, and because they're in different companies, but there was their good friend. And in talking to him, I realized, oh, you guys are actually from the same hometown. Did you know that? And so the other person was like, I didn't know that. Oh my gosh. Another person didn't know it either. I'm thinking, is your good friend? But you didn't even know you're from the same hometown. Like, so I can see how that, you know, people work parallel with each other and don't really know each other. It's
because yeah, they can work for years and not of, unless you're intentional isolated. About it, because you're given an objective and something to do and you want to be a good steward of that. So you just focus on that. And some people are relational, some people are not. The naturally relational ones will ask these questions or be more inquisitive, but not everybody's wired like that. Yeah, so when you're dealing with a team, you need both sides. You need the analytics and you need the people, right? So you got the task and the people. But kind of like when you do a good offsite, how do you get both of it? So you got to do good thinking, but you also have to have good connecting. Usually it's lacking on this side because most businesses are driven on the analytics and tasks and getting things done. That's what we get paid for. But without the relational connectivity, then you actually don't have a team. So it's like bridging the two together. And oftentimes that's part of why I add value to the communities, because they need a third person or third party to come in and go, hey, we're going to do this. And it's not just the boss saying to do it.
Yeah.
And as a result, everybody does it and they have a lot of fun. They're like, well, there's a lot of value from that. That's pretty amazing, you know?
As we're winding kind of down and kind of starting to go toward landing of this.
Yeah.
If you think back on your life.
Yeah.
You're... most meaningful memory, what would it be? Like if you're going to forget everything tomorrow, what's one thing you would want to hold with you close?
Gosh, the first thing that comes to mind is the first time I met my wife. I was actually doing kind of a fundraising pitch because I was raising money and she got invited by a friend and I just saw her and I thought, wow, she's somebody I'd really like to get to know. And I think that was a start, you know? I think that's probably one of my favorite memories is just how wonderful and charming she was. And I really wanted to get to know her, you know? And then, so I think that would be kind of the one thing I'd want to remember.
So if we're on that vein, then you could leave your wife one message. Let's say that this is the last message you're ever going to leave for her. What would that message be?
I'd just say, thank you, Sandy, for just being a light and a joy in my life. That level of acceptance and honesty and just to be myself with you. I'm grateful for all these years that we've had together, both good and the bad. For, yeah, the kids, the great kids that we've had and raising them. Yeah, that's been transformative. Being able to raise two beautiful daughters that just love God and are just wonderful people. And thanks for partnering with me in our friendship, as well as in raising our kids and building a business. Yeah, grateful.
And then if you had to choose one or two others, if you had the chance to give them a message, but you haven't had it yet, who would it be?
Gosh, I think it would be my two girls, Sophie and Sarah Ann. Thanks to your mom, you guys are the greatest joys in our life. They're just wise beyond their years. They have a good sense of what's right and wrong on their shoulders. Super responsible, but just kind people. So we see that, wow, it's just kind of everything that I wasn't growing up and just how they just have that in them. I was this total Kolohe kid and probably had to apologize for a lot of things, but for them, they tend to do the right things and are just really great kids. We're just overjoyed with how wonderful they are as people.
So say it. Yeah. So if you can, I would just say, say it as if you're saying it to them. Like you're talking directly. Yeah.
Yeah. Sophie and Sarah Ann, you guys are a joy. Your gifts are beautiful. How you guys love people are just amazing. You're wise beyond your years. You're going to make a huge contribution to our community and society. And yeah, we love you.
Your father passed away, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you remember one time in particular? Like if he had said something or done something, like said, like, my dad should have said this at this time and would have made all the difference to you.
I think I'm really...
You don't even have to say it out loud if you don't want to.
Just thinking back on some of the memories, there are a couple of times where we had some really... Like, he never really used to say, I love you or a lot of times. But I remember one time we were talking and I think he was going through something really tough. I can't remember what it was, but we had this talk. We're just kind of standing outside of the house and he basically said, you know, I really... You know, I love you. After that, he said that quite a few more times, but it's just really, I think, for him seeing and affirming me for who I am. Remember before I went off to, just before he passed away, we had some discussions because I left working. I was working at a church and said, I'm leaving the church and here's what I'm going to do. And we're sitting downstairs next to my bedroom and we're just having a conversation. I think I was probably about 26, 27 at the time. And I was explaining to him what I was going to do. And he was like, he's just really happy for me. He's like, I'm glad you're going to move beyond just working here at this kind of at a mid-level job, mid-level position at a very large church. He was really happy for me. And just glad that I was going to go back to grad school. And he's like, yeah, I really see that for you. And so that was one of the last really powerful conversations we had about purpose and calling and, yeah, before he passed away.
Well, thank you so much, Craig, for joining me today in the space for Greater Good Radio. I want to acknowledge you for always being a good friend to me, always following up when I don't follow up, always being able to offer your mana'o and your love and your support when I need it. And I wish you and your family the best.
Thank you, Evan. Appreciate it.
If you resonate with Greater Good Radio, please join our community at www.greatergoodradio.com, where you can get access to exclusive content and offerings. Hope to see you soon.